the film mentions is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying from us.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process, it can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled, and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, more so than the capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way or aware of how your data is being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago, just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, like a message came up saying, show me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of their third act lift, and it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. 3D reconstructions of superior and inferior brain regions showing regions with lower metabolism associated with the presence of atherosclerotic plaques in the carotid arteries. The color code indicates the magnitude of the observation. Yellow, strong association. Red, lower association. Gray indicates areas showing no association with carotid plaque presence. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by researchers at the CNIC titled "Scientists Uncover Early Links Between Cardiovascular Risk and Brain Metabolism." The article has appeared on the front page of the medicalexpress.com. Please stay tuned. The links between cardiovascular disease and cognitive impairment begin years before the appearance of the first clinical symptoms of either condition. In a study carried out at the Centro Nacional de Investigaciones Cardiovasculares, CNIC, in partnership with Santander Bank and neuroimaging experts, at the Barcelona Beta Brain Research Center, BBRC, the research center of the Fundación Pascual Maragall, the investigators have identified a link between brain metabolism, cardiovascular risk, and atherosclerosis during middle age, years before the first appearance of symptoms. The report, published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, JACC, is important because it suggests that intervention in a modifiable condition or cardiovascular disease could prevent the development of dementia, a disease for which there is currently no cure. Dr. Valentin Foster, CNIC and Mount Sinai Heart General Director, Physician-in-Chief of the Mount Sinai Hospital and a lead author on the study, said, "Although everybody knows about the importance of caring for ourselves and controlling cardiovascular risk factors in order to avoid a heart attack, the association of these same risk factors with cognitive decline may increase awareness of the need to acquire healthy habits from the earliest stages of life. Moreover, the results provide yet more support for the importance of implementing primary cardiovascular prevention strategies in middle age as a valuable therapeutic approach to slowing or even halting brain alterations that could contribute to future cognitive decline." The advanced stages of vascular disease and dementia often occur together, but until now, this association has not been documented at earlier stages. The CNIC-coordinated study led by Dr. Marta Cortes-Cantelli shows that in middle age, years before any clinical signs appear, atherosclerosis and cardiovascular risk factors already show an association with low metabolism in brain regions implicated in the future development of dementia, especially Alzheimer's disease. The advanced stages of neurodegenerative and vascular diseases often occur together, and research in recent years has established close links between cognitive decline and a number of cardiovascular risk factors, including hypertension, obesity, and high cholesterol. Using advanced imaging by position emission tomography, PET, the research team quantified brain metabolism in more than 500 participants in the PESA-CNIC Santander study. The participants had an average age of 50 years and no symptoms, but already had evidence of atherosclerosis in their arteries. PESA-CNIC Santander, directed by Dr. Valentin Foster, is a prospective study of more than 4,000 asymptomatic middle-aged participants who have been exhaustively assessed for the presence and progression of subclinical atherosclerosis since 2010. The new study reveals a link between elevated risk of a cardiovascular event and low brain metabolism. Study co-first author Dr. Cortes Cantelli, a CNIC investigator, and Miguel Servert, fellow, explained when brain metabolism declines, the brain's ability to handle adverse events can be compromised. Depending on the brain area affected, this can lead to a range of distinct problems. Dr. Cortes Cantelli, Dr. Juan Domingo Gispert, head of the neuroimaging group at BBRC, noted, "We found that a higher cardiovascular risk in apparently healthy middle-aged individuals was associated with lower brain metabolism in parietal-temporal regions involved in spatial and semantic memory and various types of learning, adding the brain areas showing low metabolism in participants with higher cardiovascular risk are the same areas affected in Alzheimer's disease, suggesting that these individuals may have higher than normal vulnerability to this disease. Dr. Foster asserted, "We think that cardiovascular risk factors, the effect the large vessels carrying blood from the heart to the brain also affect the small vessels in the brain." The authors say the study is the largest of its type to date in a healthy middle-aged population and could signal a paradigm change in understanding of the links between vascular and brain disease. Among the modifiable cardiovascular risk factors most closely associated with a reduction in brain metabolism, the investigators saw the biggest effect with hypertension. Dr. Foster said, "We found that the same risk factors that damage the heart and the large arteries, and especially hypertension, are closely linked to the decline in brain metabolism years before the appearance of symptoms." The research team also found that a higher number of plaques in the carotid arteries, which carry blood to the brain, was associated with lower brain metabolism in areas of the limbic system and the parietal lobe, both of which are intimately linked to the development of Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Cortes Cantelli said the next step will be to determine whether individuals with subclinical atherosclerosis in the carotid arteries and low brain metabolism at the age of 50 go on to experience cognitive decline 10 years later. Dr. Juan Domingo Gispert remarked that there is abundant evidence linking cardiovascular risk factors and Alzheimer's disease. If we can gain a more precise understanding of this relationship at asymptomatic disease stages, we will be in a position of design new strategies to prevent Alzheimer's, matching the success of current strategies to prevent cardiovascular disease. These results will be a major stimulus for the implementation of early intervention strategies to reduce the incidence of cognitive decline in old age.
Debate.
A group of United Nations rights experts have welcomed U.S. President Joe Biden's goal to close the Guantanamo Bay prison, urging Washington to ensure the crimes committed there are punished. However, Joe Biden's previous boss made that commitment also, but was unsuccessful. Why is it difficult to close a prison that is known to have committed grave human rights violations, including torture and imprisonment, without charge? Just some of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of the debate. Joining us is Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, who joins us from London, Ontario. We also have Todd Pierce, who's a former U.S. Army judge, advocate general, who joins us from Roseville, Minnesota. Welcome to you both. Todd Pierce, let me first start with you. Are you surprised that Guantanamo Bay prison is still open? What are your thoughts on it?
Unfortunately, I'm not surprised. This was so evident from the very beginning. I joined the defense in 2008, and there is just so much going on there that is illicit and illegal under international law. And then taking into account the Republican Party here and to a lesser extent the Democrats, who just don't want to let this issue go because it serves them too well politically. They'd rather sacrifice abiding by international law for a partisan advantage.
Okay, well, the couple things that you said that I think need to be highlighted, and perhaps one of them I'm going to ask you, Edward Corrigan. Why is this prison a matter of appeal for the Republicans to have it remain open, if you agree with that?
Well, the Republicans have a very strong anti-immigrant policy, and they have used Guantanamo Bay, which is part of Cuba, but they say that it's not United States territory, therefore United States law does not apply. So they've used it over the years to retain or detain various refugees and stuff that are trying to flee from countries like Haiti to make it to the United States. And so if they're picked up on sea and they're taken to Guantanamo Bay, they don't have rights as if they were on American territory. So this is a fiction that they've kept. They also have 40 prisoners there that they've not been able to deal with. And many of them were without charge. The United States chose to do a policy where they paid people a bounty to turn over people who were suspected members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Iraq. So entrepreneurial criminals turned over people that were their own enemies or just people who they didn't like or whatever reason. The Americans picked up the money and they were sent to Guantanamo Bay. And it turns So the majority of the people that were sent there had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and were detained without charge. Now, the United States has been using torture, and including waterboarding there. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the person who is allegedly the person who's behind 9/11 attacks, has been reportedly waterboarded over 160 times. And if you waterboarded me 160 times, I would probably say that I was, you know, Osama bin Laden. So, you know, evidence or confessions obtained under torture, as I'm sure our friend would say, are worthless. They're also illegal, and you can torture somebody, you get them to say anything that you want. So this is flagrant abuse, but it's been useful for the U.S., the Pentagon, for the CIA, for immigration in the United States to use this facility for their own purposes, even though Obama promised that he would try to shut it down, and now Joe Biden is the new president is echoing this same claim. But there's a lot of resistance within sort of the structures of the United States that find this probably a bit of an embarrassment, but at least a useful tool that they have to punish people and to hold people without giving them their legal rights, and also hold them without charge. So this is terrible, and a lot of people condemn this, including people who formerly worked for the in that facility in terms of a prosecutorial basis.
Well, that's what is one of the things that perhaps many are having a hard time wrapping their head around, Todd Pierce, is why what our guest there said, if indeed is true, then what purpose it serves when you more than anybody else can perhaps describe this a little further, when you have a facility that includes grave human rights violations, detained without charge, some close to 20 years, the use of torture. And I have some examples here of what some of the inmates have gone through, which in a testimony in 2018 is pretty, it's just very hard to actually try to decipher in the mind. Can you please give us some examples of the types of violations and torture, perhaps, that some of the inmates experienced there to get an idea here? I know that perhaps this is rehashing the past, but again, maybe it serves our purpose here.
No, we need to rehash the past, because the past is not the past. But unfortunately, people are forgetting or never knew so much of this as we get newer, younger people all the time. So yeah, we need to keep going back over this, because these crimes are so horrendous that we should not forget them, and they're ongoing. But, you know, the Senate torture report came out and revealed some of the tortures that they used. I don't have a list in front of me, but they're horrendous. Things like rectal feeding, which is really intended to be a form of torture. Of course, you mentioned waterboarding. You know, waterboarding supposedly wasn't done to that many people. But as somebody who once experienced some of the torture told me, that you don't need to torture everybody, you just need to torture enough to terrorize the rest of them. So there's that. But the other thing that need be considered is the Physicians for Human Rights came out with a report a number of years ago pointing out that endless detention is in itself is a form of torture. The human mind knows it's never going to get out of there. That's torturous in itself. Going back to some other tortures, sleep deprivation, which a number of people have said over time, decades, is maybe the worst of the tortures, because your body just turns to mush, you know, as you go hour, day after day without sleep. So that may well be the worst, even though a lot of people think of it as, well, maybe the mildest form of torture. But again, Solzhenitsyn and others have said, no, that was the very worst. I haven't really looked at the Senate torture report for years, actually. I should review it. But again, rectal, you know, feeding on the specious grounds that they're, you know, giving you nourishment. And again, the sleep deprivation, whole lot of varieties of that, too. So those are some of the tortures that have been used. And then just the endless detention, permanent detention, that the mind, you know, these people have to know that they're never going to see the outside world again, never see their families again. That's torturous in itself.
Okay, you mentioned, Edward Corrigan, that U.S. officials generally speaking, have helped this detention facility to stay open because it served their purpose. What kind of purpose does it serve when you have confessions that are forced through the different types of torture methods, when it turns out, as you even said, that these people weren't even part of Al-Qaeda, or if they were any type of extremists in their own way, they were not affiliated with the 9/11 attacks, for example. So what kind of purpose did they serve?
Well, it serves sort of an element of sort of propaganda, in that the United States says that these people are there, they're a threat to the United States. We've obtained confessions, in quotation marks, that they have been involved with attacks on the U.S., especially the 9/11. In Canada, we have a doctrine called the Ashcroft Doctrine, that if you're not brought to charge and trial within a very short period of time, you are released because it's unconstitutional. There are people who have been in jail there for almost 20 years. My conclusion is that the United States is hoping that these people will die and they'll never have a public trial. But there's also a problem, I think, in having these secret trials that are done by the military. And the reality is that confessions obtained by torture are not reliable. In fact, the people who are torturing quite often give out information that they want people to embrace and to report back to them. So as if it provides a validation for what they say. So you torture people, tell them what they want. Eventually, they will pick up on it and they'll tell you what you want to hear just to make the torture stop. But this is, as I said, the CIA, the Pentagon, immigration, other elements like this, and it, of course, presents as legal fiction. Oh, they're not really in the United States, even though it's an American naval base that's been in Cuba since around 1898, when the United States invaded Cuba during the Spanish-American War. But, it does do this legal fiction that, yes, we have evidence, because a lot of the evidence for 9/11 supposedly came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but as I said, it was done through torture. And if you torture somebody, eventually they will tell you what you want to hear just to make the torture stop. And they haven't put people on trial, even though there was recent, discussion of again closing down Guantanamo Bay, or Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, other human rights organizations, including and the United States Senate, their report, all condemn Guantanamo Bay. Yet, even when the President of the United States says that they want to close it down, he was unable to do so because there's a lot of pushback from elements within the Pentagon and the CIA, where they use it to support arguments that they want and to justify the so-called war on terrorism, when a lot of it is simply not true. And a number of people have resigned from the prosecution of these inmates at Guantanamo Bay because of the torture, because of the delays and other problems, which would not be allowed to exist if this was done through a normal court procedure, or even in the United States under the rules of the court and law. It's a useful tool, but it really isn't a useful tool. It's more for propaganda purposes and to sort of legitimate the so-called war on terror, when really other things are going on. And these people are held without charge and without any evidence other than maybe somebody else is saying that they are a member of Al-Qaeda. But when you say that somebody, you can offer reward for people who are supposedly members of Al-Qaeda, people turn over people, they pick up the reward, they're gone, and you're left stuck with this detainee. And the United States also hasn't been able to find places or countries to accept these detainees because they're supposedly alleged terrorists, but the Americans don't know what to do with them. And they keep stalling and delaying. Uh-huh. And this would be illegal in Canada, I think, and most other countries too.
Okay, Todd Pierce, you had the former U.S. President Barack Obama make an announcement that this is a stain on the U.S.'s human rights record and that it should be shut. Now you have the current U.S. President, in which he has said the same thing, that it should be shut. Why wasn't Obama able to do it, and what do you think Joe Biden will... do you think that Joe Biden actually will be successful in doing what his former boss couldn't or didn't?
Let me point out something first, though. Closing Guantanamo is not the critical issue. If it just means sending these 40 remaining people, some of whom I suspect are in vegetative states by now. I mean, genuinely a vegetative state. So that would provide one reason why they're not worrying about getting them, you know, sending them to other countries. They don't want that out, what they've done to them. But the other thing is, you know, closing Guantanamo, if it just means sending these 40 people to supermax prisons in the United States and forgetting about them, making the crime even worse, that's, you know, is not the sole, should not be the sole objective. The bigger problem is that what the United States did following 9/11, and Karl Rove, you know, told it, you know, I guess it was Karl Rove who said, told the Republicans that now they own the, you know, own the issue of terrorism and would keep getting him reelected. Trump wrote in on that when he said that, well, sure, he'll try torture again. But what they did was they invented out of whole cloth a thing that they call law, but it's really just a variety of global martial law. And in fact, one commentator actually put that into a book and said, yeah, seems like a lot like global martial law. Well, it is. It's a deeper issue than we have time to go into here. But when Cheney said, you know, issued a report back in 1992 that the United States now basically ruled the world, well, the next step then was, well, how are we going to enforce this military rule? And with 9/11, it gave them the perfect opportunity. And so if you read carefully, all these arguments have been made over time. We're basically making an argument, the United States, that we now rule the world and we're exercising martial law. And when you have martial law, you have military commissions. And so these people, the detainees, the prisoners, you know, are useful in sort of making that case that, yeah, we have this authority, we have this jurisdiction over the entire globe. And it reaches far into so many other areas. Free speech, like WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks has committed no crime. Julian Assange has committed no crime, other than, no crime. But what he did do is he revealed U.S. war crimes. And so he's being held and will be prosecuted under basically what was the provisions of the Espionage Act, which was originally the Sedition Act, or, you know, in conjunction. You know, in other words, he's showing disloyalty, even though he has no duty of loyalty. It's a convoluted argument you got to dig into to really see what's going on with the argument the United States has made. But it's a totalitarian. It's a totalitarian argument they made. And so the issue is goes beyond just the physical location of Guantanamo, but rather this entire infrastructure, you know, unlawful infrastructure they've created to go along with it, and now use Guantanamo to justify it.
A notion here that came up, Edward Corrigan, is the fact that perhaps what our guest there said is a valid point, that this is not about just closing Guantanamo. Let me ask you this, Edward Corrigan. In the bigger picture, we heard about what's called these CIA black sites, where there's torture rooms, and they're at various sites across the world. My question comes about as to how widespread is this whole torture regime, if you want to call it, that the U.S. exercises, that perhaps the CIA is a major architect behind it, as it was for many of the torture techniques that were exercised or executed at Guantanamo Bay. In other words, how wide and big a field is this that the U.S. uses when it comes to detainment or when it comes to what they perceive to be terror suspects, for example?
Well, I agree with the other commentator in that this is a much bigger problem. Guantanamo Bay may be this, you know, symbolic, but there was Abu Ghraib prison, and, you know, prisons in Afghanistan that were used for torture and for sexual humiliation, and the CIA set up prisons around various client states, so they were in Poland, elsewhere. And people were tortured there. And it's, oh, this is not the United States, therefore people aren't entitled to the legal protections of the Constitution and the rule of law. And you know, it really is sort of, I think, a sick mentality that you can go and, to hold people in other countries, say, oh, they're not entitled to rights as if they were in the United States. That's why they're afraid to let people go to the U.S., because then they would become under judicial scrutiny. and would be entitled to, you know, make an asylum claim, for example, or to, you know, to have a proper defense in a public trial. So, you know, the United States, you know, they say that they're democracies for human rights, but they're, you know, if you really look under the sort of the cover, you see that there's a lot of terrible things that go on. And we don't even know maybe a lot of it, but the stuff that has become public, it's terrifying. And as I said, I said earlier, torture does not work. You can torture people to get them to say anything you want, or to, you know, to implicate other people, and it's simply not true. You know, the experts say that torture simply is not an effective way for getting, you know, truthful information. But the CIA and other agencies in the United States are not interested in that. They're there for political games. So this is, you know, justifies terrorism or war on terrorism. It's to protect the United States, when in fact there's a lot of other stuff going on. And, you know, there's been numerous these, you know, secret prisons where people were tortured, and, you know, getting people, even in Syria, they had set up torture sites for American prisoners. So it's in my mind, it doesn't work. It's a great disgrace to the United States, and Obama and Biden and many others have recognized. But they still, the powers within the United States, you know, military industrial complex and maybe prison complex now, because they're holding people prisoners for profit. This all, you know, it is like a totalitarian state, like, you know, our friend has said, and it is a disgrace. But most Americans don't want to know this. They, you know, they shut their mind to it, and of course it creates this legal fiction that somehow they're doing something that they're allowed to do, because they've created this regime of, what do they call it, these sort of non-combatants that they take, but they use their own evidence. And, you know, so the rule of law is not really applied here, and in fact is being perverted to accomplish other objectives, which are terrible, of course, the world, and allows the United States to use reprehensible methods to try to enforce its authority and to punish people who step out of line. Like Julian Assange, you know, is an Australian citizen, and they're trying to use him, but he, as our friend said, he just exposed the truth.
Okay.
And that was, you know, torture and other things that the United States is doing that constitute as war crimes.
Uh-huh. My final question, Todd Pierce, goes to you. You have 40 people that are at Guantanamo Bay Prison. These UN working groups have welcomed, obviously, what Joe Biden has said in terms of closing Guantanamo. Why doesn't Joe Biden show goodwill and do something about these 40 people who are there, and then maybe eventually go to and close this prison, if he's very sincere? Why just make an announcement and then review and then see what happens? And we know how that goes. And furthermore, why he has made that announcement, if you think that he is sincere in doing so.
I'll answer just two things very quickly. The other gentleman mentioned American prisoners in Syria. Let me clarify that what that meant was we initially basically farmed out to the Syrians to torture the prisoners we were capturing. So we were happy to use Assad's prisons for them to torture the prisoners that we gave them, the Muslims that we captured and turned over to be tortured to other outside contractors, call it. The other thing is, I recommend people reading the Jakarta Method as a book, which shows that the United States has been up to this kind of illegality far, far, far longer than the global war on terror. But to the question of what can Joe Biden do? Obviously, I wish that he would really do a thorough review of our whole global war on terror policy. But again, the political opposition, fully the 100% of the Republican Party and probably 70% of the Democrats, just wild numbers, you know, hypothetical numbers, but pretty close, would oppose him, you know, vigorously. We saw that with Obama when he even talked about closing Guantanamo,
right,
how the Republican Party turned upon him.
Okay.
And passed legislation prohibiting bringing people in.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Todd Pierce, thank you. Former U.S. Army Judge Advocate General. And thank you, Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer. And that is it for this edition of the debate. From Mika Batali, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
About half of American workers rely on employer-provided health insurance. So, by last June, as COVID-19 caused joblessness to skyrocket, nearly 8 million working adults and nearly 7 million of their dependents lost their coverage once they became unemployed. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Rajan Menon, author. This article is published under the heading, Over 33% of U.S. low-paid workers lost jobs during pandemic. Stay tuned for the details, please. The economic fallout from the pandemic has tested the U.S. social safety net as never before. Between February and May 2020, the number of unemployed workers soared more than threefold, from 6.2 million to 20.5 million. The jobless rate spiked in a similar fashion from 3.8% to 13%. In late March, weekly unemployment claims reached 6.9 million. Obliterating the previous record of 695,000 set in October 1982. Within 3 months, the pandemic-produced slump proved far worse than the three-year Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. Things have since improved. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, announced in December that unemployment had fallen to 6.7%. Yet that same month, weekly unemployment filings still reached a staggering 853,000, and though they fell to just under 800,000 last month, even that far surpassed the 1982 number. And keep in mind that grim statistics like these can actually obscure, rather than illuminate, the depth of the U.S. current misery. After all, they exclude the 6.2 million Americans whose work hours had been slashed in December, or the 7.3 million who had simply stopped looking for jobs because they were demoralized, feared being infected by the virus, had school children at home, or some of the above and more. The BLS rationale for not counting them is that they are no longer part of what it terms the active labor force. If they had been included, that jobless rate would have spiraled to nearly 24% in April and 11.6% in December. To see just how unevenly the economic pain has been distributed in America, however, you have to dig far deeper. A recent analysis by St. Louis Federal Reserve did just that by dividing workers into five separate quintiles based on their range of incomes and the occupations typically associated with each. The first and lowest paid group, including janitors, cooks, and house cleaners, made less than $35,000 annually. The second, that is construction workers, security guards, and clerks, among others, earned $35,000 to $48,000. The third, including primary and middle school teachers, as well as retail and postal workers, $48,000 to $60,000. The fourth, including nurses, paralegals, and computer technicians, $60,000 to $83,000. While employees in the highest paid quintile, like doctors, lawyers, and financial managers, earned a minimum of $84,000. More than 33% of those in the lowest paid group lost their jobs during the pandemic, and a similar proportion were forced to work fewer hours. By contrast, in the top quintile, 5.6% were out of work, and 5.4% had their hours cut. For the next highest quintile, the corresponding figures were 11.4% and 11.7%. Workers in the bottom 20% of national income distribution have been especially vulnerable for another reason. Their median liquid savings, readily available cash, averages less than $600 compared to $31,300 for those in the top 20%. 12% of working Americans can't even handle a $400 emergency. 27% say they could, but only if they borrowed, used credit cards, or sold their personal possessions. Under the circumstances, it should scarcely be surprising that the number of hungry people increased from 35 million in 2019 to 50 million in 2020, overwhelming food banks nationwide. Meanwhile, rent and mortgage arrears continue to pile up. By last December, 12 million people already owed nearly $6,000 each on average in past due rent and utility bills, and will be on the hook to their landlords for those sums once federal and state moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures eventually end. Meanwhile, low-income workers struggle to arrange childcare as schools close to curtail coronavirus infections. Women have borne the brunt of the resulting burden. While last summer, 13% of workers unable to afford childcare had already quit their jobs or reduced their hours, and most held low-wage jobs to begin with. 46% of women have jobs with a median hourly wage of $10.93 an hour, or less than $23,000 a year, far below the national average, now just shy of $36,000. In some low-wage professions like servers in restaurants, women are, at least were, 70% of the workforce. A disproportionate number of them were also Black or Hispanic. Before the pandemic, 57% of women in low-wage occupations worked full-time, and 15% of them were single parents. Close to one-fifth had children under 4 years old and contend with full-time care that on average costs $9,598 yearly. If that weren't enough, at least 25% of such low-wage jobs involved shifting or unpredictable schedules. Much has been made recently of the wonders of telecommunicating to work. But here again, there is a social divide. People with at least a college degree who are more likely to possess the skills needed for higher-paying jobs have been 6 times more likely to telecommute than other workers. Even before the pandemic, 47% of those with college degrees occasionally worked from home versus 9% of those who had completed high school and a mere 3% of those who hadn't. Now, add to the economic inequities highlighted by the pandemic slump those rooted in race. Black and Hispanic low-income workers have been doubly disadvantaged. In 2016, the median household wealth of whites was already 10 times that of Blacks and more than 8 times that of Hispanics, a gap that has generally been on the increase since 1960s. And because those two groups have been overrepresented among low-wage occupations most affected by unemployment in the last year, their jobless rates during the pandemic has been much higher. Unsurprisingly, an AUKUS Pew Research Center survey revealed that significantly more than of them than whites were struggling to cover utility bills and rent or mortgage payments. After COVID-19 hammered the economy, a much higher proportion of them were also hungry and had to turn to food pantries, many for the first time. In these months, Americans who are less educated, hold low-income jobs, and are minorities, Asians expected, since they, like whites, are underrepresented in low-wage professions, have been in an economic COVID-19 hell on earth. But isn't the American social safety net supposed to help the vulnerable in times of economic distress? As it happens, at least compared to those of other wealthy countries, it has been remarkably ineffective.